dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a pleasure to have with us the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy. On occasion, he is guest hosting for me, which I'm always grateful for as well, but the best of times, as far as I'm concerned, is when I get to talk to him myself, and that's the case right now. We will discuss with Jim Hansen, a former Green Beret, now serving as the leader of the Special Forces in the War of Ideas at the Center for Security Policy, back in the saddle. Jim, it's good to have you. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Jim, let me ask you, first of all, about Syria. Of course, this is dominating the news at the moment. We haven't talked on air since the United States military attacked the airfield from which an alleged chemical weapon strike by the Assad government took place. Are you satisfied, Jim, that indeed it was the Syrian government that used sarin nerve agent against innocent civilians?
I don't see how it could be anyone else, Frank. You know, there's a lot of talk. People want to say it was a hoax, say it was a false flag operation. The United States can tell who goes where anywhere in the air. So this was an airstrike. We can backtrack everything. We've got just amazing coverage of anything flying anywhere, especially in an active battle zone. So the idea that we don't have definitive knowledge that the strike came from a particular aircraft leaving a particular airbase is absurd. Of course we do. And the president would have been briefed on all this before he even contemplated striking anyone, because you need to strike the person who did it. So in this case, the strike came from that airfield. And in the end, you know, we don't know the command and control structure particularly well inside Syria right now. I don't know anyone does, but it was the Syrian government who owns that airbase, and their friends, the Russians, were there as well.
Well, that brings the next question up, Jim. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is in Moscow as we speak and is apparently going to be talking, among other topics, with his Russian counterpart and perhaps others about this attack and where this leaves us in Syria. The Russians were operating from that base, have been closely allied with, indeed have helped save the bacon of, if I can use that expression, Bashar Assad. Where do you come down on the question of whether they knew about this attack, assuming it was indeed the Assad government that precipitated it, and they were either ignorant or complicit in it going forward?
I find it hard to believe that they didn't know. You know, if you wanted to convince me that the Russians were unaware of that, you'd have to convince me that they're not operating like the Russians. You know, they are the puppet masters of the Assad regime. That, like you said, they have kept him operational for far too long. And, you know, the fact that something like that happens without their consent at a minimum, or the turning of a blind eye, being shocked, I say, that there's, you know, chemical weapons attacks coming from this airbase. It's a very lame way to try and avoid responsibility. So I think they knew, and I think in whatever way, they were okay with the chaos this was going to cause, which is probably more concerning about than the actual attack itself.
Yeah. Jim, with respect to the Russians and their knowledge of what's going on in Syria, we apparently know where chemical weapons have been stockpiled on this base. Presumably the Russians do as well. What does that say about the Russian, well, again, complicity in lying about the so-called deal that John Kerry struck with his counterpart Lavrov to rid Syria of its chemical arsenal?
Like pretty much everything else the Obama administration did, it was more of a, you know, a front than an actual deal. They wanted to be able to say they had taken these out of play So then they had an excuse for sitting on the sidelines while the slaughter went on. Like, well, you know, we don't have to worry about red lines or chemical weapons or any of the rest of this. We made a deal. So therefore, there is no problem. And what baffles me is how they can believe that when you're dealing with someone who is not going to abide by the deal, they don't think that's going to come back and bite them. You know, and now they were all on television bragging and preening about this deal. And now there's more dead Syrian civilians. And the blame for that may lie at Assad's feet for ordering the raid and Putin's for letting it happen. But it's on Obama for allowing that all to happen.
Yeah, for the capabilities to remain in place. Jim, let me ask you with respect to Secretary Tillerson in Moscow. Apparently, he's going to be pressing the Russians to cut their losses on Assad, to allow him to be removed from power and replaced. It's not entirely clear, at least to me, by whom, but to at least end this phase of the civil war in Syria. Would you make book on the probabilities of success at that? And if so, what does it look like? What comes next in Syria?
Yeah, great question. And I think that is the big unanswered question in both Syria and Iraq. You know, Assad can't govern the country that's left based on the borders that are there. And on the other side of the caliphate, there is no way the central government in Baghdad can govern the Sunni areas of Iraq without being blatantly and horribly oppressive to the population there. So you've got a huge problem. You know, killing ISIS there is a great idea. You have to start with that because you can't let them continue to operate their caliphate. But who comes next? I think it's fair for the U.S. to say Assad's time has passed and probably make some kind of deal with Putin that says pick a new tyrant. You know, they're not going to leave. They're not going to give up their warm water port. They're not going to give up the advantages of having a toehold in that area. So let them pick a new tyrant at least so we can go ahead and have a you know, face-saving operation for both them and us. And then we'll have to figure out what to do with the rest of Syria and the rest of Iraq, because it's going to be as big a mess absent ISIS as it was with them.
Yeah. Well, and among the contenders for that, you know, successor to Assad, unfortunately, will be a succession of Syrian strongmen aligned with the Iranians, Hezbollah, as well as the Russians, perhaps. Alternatively, the very bad actors that are in the Sunni Sharia supremacist camp, whether it's the folks that the Saudis like, or the folks the Turks like, or the folks that are doing business as Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, and so on. It's a real witch's brew, needless to say. You'll be following it closely at the Center for Security Policy, Jim Hansen, and I'm grateful for that. Let me ask you, Jim, about one other issue. Of course, as all of this is going down and causing a lot of focus to shift to the other side of the world. Meanwhile, back in North Korea, things seem to be hotting up. You spent time worrying about that problem as a Green Beret. Tell us what your take is now with the arrival on station of the USS Carl Vinson battle group and the potential of nuclear and or missile tests out of North Korea that could further provoke action on the part of others.
You know, the problem, Frank, is we've had a succession of Kims running North Korea as a hellish nightmare for decades now. And this one is the craziest of the bunch. You know, they've been getting progressively worse and less rational. And so the idea that the normal, you know, mechanisms for controlling anything like that will work, I don't see how anyone could believe that's a certainty. So you have to make the gestures. You have to, you know, I'm sure that the topic was on the discussion in Mar-a-Lago when President Trump was meeting with the Chinese leader and talking about whether or not they can actually rein him in or whether he's gone beyond their complete control. If he does something now in the current frame of reference, you know, with issues in Syria between us and Russia, and takes advantage of that to go ahead and push his agenda, I don't know what we can do to actually affect that short of a just almost uncontemplatable war between the North and the South in Korea. So it's a bad situation for us. Our leverage is very limited. Carl Vinson is a great threat, but making good on that threat unleashes things that, you know, factors and unintended consequences that we just absolutely can't know what the answer is. We know they've got nukes. We know they've got missiles. And the consequences of Kim actually snapping and losing it are not a pretty thing for anybody to think about.
Jim Henson, thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us next week. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk with her about conservatives and Putin and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Diana West, a privilege we have each week at about this time, syndicated columnist for many years, a blogger of superb output at dianawest.net. She is the author of two best-selling books, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, so good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back.
We have, of course, as we speak, the images coming from Moscow of Rex Tillerson meeting with his counterpart and perhaps others. You've written a very interesting piece at the website, dianawest.net, entitled The Pied Putin of Conservative Land, which investigates really what a lot of conservatives are thinking these days about Putin. What would be the essence of that thinking as you see it, Diana, and what's wrong with it?
Well, I think the essence of that thinking is that over the past several years, Vladimir Putin has presented himself in a guise of being a Christian and a nationalist. And it seems to have worked with many conservatives who now view him as a Christian and a nationalist. And when I look at what he says and what I try to analyze in my essay, and I also reposted a very astute essay by J.R. Nyquist, also on the subject of Putin and conservatives, looking at other statements he's making, I hear disinformation. And in particular, in looking at what I think was Putin sort of coming out as a savior of Western civilization, as it were, back in 2013, he gave a speech at a conference in Valdez that was quite commented upon, and he discusses how important the roots of Christianity are and our moral principles and traditional identities, and he sounded like a social conservative speaking until you actually remember that the Soviet Union and Marxism and communism, globally implemented, were all designed to destroy Christianity, traditional.
And he, of course, was an agent of the Soviet Empire back in the KGB in the day. And Diana, you were talking about this speech that Putin made. Starting there, but moving forward, of course, we've seen lots of people seeing in him and in his response, particularly to the Islamist threat, a kind of savior. Among them, of course, it appeared for a time at least, was Donald Trump. Talk about that.
Yes, well, I think this is part of the same campaign of deception, or campaign of strategy more than deception, because Russia is always thinking the long game, and Putin is no different. And when we actually look at how he can manipulate us, it makes great sense for him to enthrall the right. And in particular, we've recently seen people like Christopher Caldwell and Ann Coulter also seeming to sing his praises in this regard. This is something Donald Trump certainly discussed in kind of his telegraphic shorthand on the campaign trail, drawing much consternation. I was hoping it had a bit to do with his understanding that it was good not to saber rattle while America's military was falling into the tank, which is really what we've been looking at over the past years of war and Obama's attacks on our own military, you might say, in terms of not replenishing and rebuilding, et cetera.
And the social engineering on all the rest.
And social engineering. And again, going back to the one point I did want to add to the note of Putin making these same points about Western civilization and not explaining that this was exactly the campaign of Marxism to create the new Soviet man, as it were, which is what we live with in the West. Not in Russia, interestingly enough, but cultural Marxism has recreated the West to a point where it cannot defend itself, whether from the left or from the Islamic threat. And to me, someone who had genuinely made a break from this tradition, as Putin is alleged to have done, would help us understand this. But of course, it's just another layer, another tool, another vector of manipulation.
So, Diana, let me ask you, we have Rex Tillerson there, as I mentioned, the Secretary of State, and forefront of their conversations, supposedly, will be trying to fashion some kind of partnership with Russia on Syria and the removal of Bashar Assad. I mean, you're a serious student of what the Russians are up to and have been for many decades now. And I commend it once again to everybody, your terrific book on the subject, American Betrayal. When you look at this current vortex, really, the post-strike in Syria by the Trump administration, the conversations in Russia at the moment, what's your crystal ball telling you is likely to come out of all of this?
Well, my crystal ball is rather cloudy at the moment, I have to say, frankly, partly because goodness knows what will come out of Rex Tillerson's mouth. He's been all over the map as he's come out on the world stage, it seemingly within the last 48 to 72 hours, with all kinds of statements that seem to encompass a humanitarian world war in terms of defending innocence everywhere, so-called, quote, innocence.
You know, the responsibility to protect of the Obama years.
Yes, sounding very much like the previous administration. So we're getting a very mixed messaging here. To ask Russia to cooperate on Syria, having just conducted this strike, I don't quite see the jujitsu diplomacy there. This to me was a very feckless lashing out. And if it's true, it was because of photographs that Ivanka Trump brought to President Trump. We are really in for a rough ride. I mean, this is not the way a commander in chief conducts policy and puts troops in harm's way. So I am personally still recovering from this, what I consider demoralizing act. By Donald Trump, who had campaigned on not starting wars of choice and certainly not becoming involved in regime change.
Then let me turn to one other topic very quickly. We only have about a minute and a half left. But Guy Molière, a writer for the Gatestone Institute, has just done a very interesting and thoughtful piece about Geert Wilders, our friend in the effort to spare Western civilization, notably in his native Netherlands, from the predations of the Hydra, as they call it. Talk a little bit about Geert and where you think his stance is at the moment in terms of the broader perceptions of the Europeans.
Well, I think that's an excellent question because, again, it's important for Americans to learn to look at things with a wider perspective lens. And if we look at how the strike on Syria looks to the European right, of whom Geert Wilders is the leading representative and the most successful representative in terms of protecting Europe from further Islamization and the depredations of the European Union on sovereignty, which made them all very natural allies of Donald Trump. I mean, this was something we watched take hold. The strike on Assad, they understand that as America joining al-Qaeda, because, of course, most of the people that Assad is fighting are the same people trying to get into Europe who are going and committing acts of terrorism, who are on watch lists. This to them is a betrayal. I have heard from some in Europe, and this is how the people fighting Islamization of Europe and fighting this battle daily in their own streets. Every day we're looking at this kind of jihad terror. They see that lining up with the rebels, the opposition, so-called, that
the so-called moderates, yeah, who we apparently think are going to be the alternative to Assad.
Yeah, they see Donald Trump having joined the jihad, and
this is,
I do too.
A subject to which we will return, I know. Diana West, thank you very much. We have to run. Keep up the great work at dianawest.net. Stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll talk with Peter Pry, with whom I had the privilege of testifying in Austin, Texas, about the electric grid. That and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of the country's true authorities on what I consider to be, and I know he does, the single most serious threat to America and to her people of all. And that is the danger that someone, somewhere, using some technique, may take down the grid, the electric infrastructure of the United States, with truly catastrophic effects. Peter and I appeared together yesterday, I'm very pleased to say, as witnesses before the Texas State Senate's Business and Commerce Committee to urge legislation in that committee to do something to begin the process of protecting Texas's grid, which is essentially independent of the rest of the countries and a hugely important asset in that regard and testbed, really, for what could be done for the country and must be done for the country. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is, among other things, the chief of staff of the congressionally mandated EMP Commission, Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. He's also the executive director of the Congressional Task Force on National and Homeland Security, a longtime analyst in the Central Intelligence Agency, and also a professional staff member on the House Armed Services Committee. Good friend and very valued colleague. Welcome back, Peter. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, Peter, let me ask you about your appearance yesterday and the way this went down. Talk a little bit about what the bill is that's been offered by State Senator Bob Hall and its importance as you see it.
Senate Bill 83 is designed to establish an independent panel of experts and emergency managers to come up with a plan to protect the Texas electric grid, to consult with outside professionals about doing it, to find out how much it's going to cost and what would have to be done to protect that part of the grid managed by ERCOT, which is most of the Texas electric grid. This is consistent with what the EMP Commission has been recommending for 8 years, that that states shouldn't wait for Washington, that, of course, we should seek a solution as well at the federal level, attack the bridge from both ends, but that states, you know, who have greater legal authorities over their local utilities should be taking initiatives like this to try to protect themselves. It's called islanding, you know, where a state, even if it's part of a larger regional grid, can install blocking devices and surge arresters and the like to protect its assets from a nuclear EMP attack or a natural EMP from the sun or from cyber attacks and physical sabotage. You know, the commission concluded that if you protect against the worst of these threats, nuclear EMP attack, it will mitigate all the others. And Texas is, of course, in a unique situation relative to the other states because it's the only state that, in effect, has its own electric grid.
Dr. Pry, we appeared on a panel with a individual representing the Electric Industries Research Institute, known as EPRI. Talk for briefly, if you would, about his testimony and the reaction of the chairman, Texas State Senator Kelly Hancock, to it.
The Electric Power Research Institute, Randy Horton, was their so-called expert witness. And EPRI has done a study that basically comes to just exactly the opposite conclusions that the Congressional EMP Commission and every other major study that has been done on the electric grid. EPRI concludes that a nuclear EMP attack, even using a 1 megaton weapon, a weapon that's got a yield of over 1 megaton, would destroy few, if any, extra high voltage transformers. And the implications, the further incorrect implications they draw from that is that therefore we might be able to very quickly recover from an EMP, and long-lasting damage that puts at risk many lives, would not occur. Because EPRI also misunderstands, in addition to getting their calculations wrong on what would happen to EHV transformers, they also fundamentally misunderstand the problem and think that the threat is all about the EHV transformers, when it's not. Even if they were correct and few EHV transformers were destroyed, by losing tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of SCADA systems and other control systems to the E1 EMP effect, that too would result in a protracted blackout that could last over a year and cost 90% of the American population their lives.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a moment, Peter Pry, but one of the things that I was particularly struck by was the incredulity of Texas State Senator Kelly Hancock to a business model in which the electric utilities seemingly would be so indifferent to the possible dangerous impact of a grid down situation to their customers, and therefore seem to call into question why they would be dissembling about this, why they would be lowballing the threat. Could you just quickly address that? I know you didn't get a chance to yesterday in the hearing, but give us your feedback as to what the proper way to understand what the utilities are up to here actually is.
I know you didn't get a chance to respond either, Frank, and you were just as anxious as I was. And I think the chairman invited, or one of his colleagues invited us to submit our response in writing. He was, in effect, answering a rhetorical question that he didn't want answered by us. I think that was pretty obvious. But there is an obvious answer to it, and that is that historically, we can't rely on the private sector, for-profit sector of our society to provide for our national and homeland security, for public safety. We know from our long history that this is why you must have government. Now, even the founders, who are the ultimate libertarians, couldn't do away with government entirely, because they knew you needed government to provide for national security and public safety, because the private sector won't do that. They always put profits and their short-term gains ahead of public safety. And to give us some examples, of this, for example, if the chairman of that committee had existed in the age of the Zeppelin, I have no doubt that he would be aghast at the implication that travel by hydrogen balloon was unsafe, because the Zeppelin industry, of course, would never put its customers at risk by traveling by hydrogen balloon. And yet we know they did, and they put their whole industry out of business by taking this incredible risk until the Hindenburg incident put the whole Zeppelin industry out of business.
You mentioned that perhaps as many as 90% of the American people might perish in the event of a protracted, widespread grid-down situation. I know that was a finding of the chairman of your EMP commission, Bill Graham. You've been taken to task about this when you and former CIA Director Jim Woolsey opined about this, warned about it in the connection with a North Korean EMP attack on this country. Give us very quickly your response to Popular Mechanics.
Well, the author, Kyle Mizukami, lied to the readers of Popular Mechanics, and he claimed that it was not an EMP commission judgment that 9 of 10 Americans could die from a protracted blackout, but rather that this came from a novel, Bill Fortune's novel, One Second After. And that's simply untrue. The EMP Commission did look rigorously at what the consequences of an EMP would be, including to the survival of the population, and came to the judgment that up to 90% of the population could die, because there's only a 30-day food supply and the big regional food warehouses. We don't know how to feed 320 million people for a year when there's only enough food to feed that number of people for 30 days in the country, and without water, which would be gone immediately, not to mention the massive environmental catastrophes from nuclear reactors going to Fukushima and gas pipelines exploding and the like.
Finances being unavailable and transportation and communications and on and on. No, I think this is a very credible assessment needless to say, but it is frustrating when you have outlets like Popular Mechanics, which are supposedly rigorous in their understanding of technology and threats to it, that are so badly mistaken in their assessments. Peter Pryke, thank you so much for the incredible service to our country that you have provided for so long and are continuing to do so as the Chief of Staff of the EMP Commission. We look forward to its next report coming out shortly. Next up, we'll be speaking with Russ Dallin about developments in Venezuela and what is afoot there that might result in problems for us as well. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Russ Dallin, a man we've come to turn to with regularity on matters involving Latin America and particularly latest developments in Venezuela. He is the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune, which is doing extraordinarily important work covering these matters. He's also the head of the international investment bank known as Caracas Capital Markets, a man who testified before the United States House of Representatives with considerable effect, it turns out, last week, and we're anxious to get an update from him on all of this. Russ, it's good to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Secretary Gaffney, it's always a pleasure and a learning experience.
Thank you. Let me ask you about your testimony last week, Russ, for starters. You were appearing, of course, before the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and you really made a point of introducing to them a topic that we've discussed before and that's very worrying to me as well. Talk a little bit about Rosneft and what it's doing at the moment with respect to Venezuela and perhaps us.
Well, as the Venezuelan situation continues to decline, they are looking for coins underneath every couch cushion. The Russians have been more than happy to accommodate them, buying assets that have been expropriated from the Americans at and still unpaid for, whether it be ExxonMobil or ConocoPhillips, but selling those assets to the Russians for a skinny chicken prices, as the Venezuelans say in their parlance. One of the assets that Venezuela has found to pawn to Russia is Citgo, and we uncovered it after we couldn't explain an extra $890 million that showed up in the central bank's reserves and set out on a three-week journey to try and find how that money came about. It turns out that Rosneft, which is a sanctioned company, sanctioned on the OFAC list, that's the Office of Foreign Assets Control list, led by a sanctioned individual in Igor Session, who is a right-hand man to Putin, also on that list, loaned Venezuela for just under 50% of Citgo in the United States, with all of its three refineries, including the sixth largest refinery in the U.S. and pipeline and terminal networks across 24 states in the United States, gave that the rights to that to Rosneft.
Which, of course, is a state-owned Russian conglomerate tied in a number of ways to the Putin regime and some rather bad business as well.
Absolutely, it is owned majority owned by the state, but more importantly controlled by the state. As I said, by Putin's right hand guy, who put there. He was Putin's deputy when Putin was assistant or was a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. So
what you were testifying on this, if I may, just Russ, to cut to the chase here, raising an alarm about this with the Congress. And that seems to have prompted the chairman of the subcommittee and his ranking member to engage directly with the Treasury Department about this matter. Tell us a little bit about that and where you think things are likely to go from here.
Yes, and as you've noted, and having Chairman Duncan on your show, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere, as along with the ranking member, Mr. Representative Albio Ceres of New Jersey, both sent a letter calling on the Treasury Secretary, who heads the Council or the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which is responsible for reviewing these national security threats through purchases of foreigners, to review the Citgo and Rosneft deal. And I'm also pleased to say that the Senate has joined in with Senator Rubio and Senator Menendez, and four other senators have also sent a similar letter from the Senate yesterday.
Very important. So do you anticipate that this will translate, this so-called CFIUS review, should it happen, will translate into the prevention of this Russian takeover of these assets in the United States?
I certainly hope so, Frank, but politics is politics. In the past, CFIUS has allowed things, you know, business being business and politics being politics, has allowed those kind of things to pass before, and it has been Congress that has stood up and said, no, this you shall not pass. This deal, and both the Chinese have been forced to back down on assets, Dubai and United Arab Emirates, and even in the past, Rosneft was going to buy a part of Morgan Stanley that was responsible for oil trading, and that deal got scotched actually as well.
Yeah. Let me just ask you, Russ, because one of the things that I've called for in my commentary today is for Rex Tillerson in Moscow, as we speak, to serve notice on the Russians that we're not about to let this kind of transaction go forward when it would result in a guy in the person of Vladimir Putin who has made explicit his desire to, you know, hurt at the very least, if not destroy, the U.S. energy sector to take ownership of key parts of it.
It is certainly... certainly one of the things I even heard this morning that the Pentagon has awarded a contract to United Airlines to forcibly remove Assad. That's a sorry.
A joke, son. A joke. Yeah, well, yeah, I hope you'll get rough treatment, but I don't know that it'll be at their hands. Let me just ask you, because this is really a moment of great peril, it seems to me, on so many different levels. In terms of what's happening in Venezuela, you've just shared with me, Russ Dallin, that the Latin American Herald Tribune has just reported on the latest incident in Venezuela, indicating that Maduro himself is now personally under assault. Talk a little bit about that.
So, yes, last night during a mandatory chain broadcast of celebrating some 200-year-old battles in the Bolivar State area of Venezuela, the president of Venezuela, standing in one of the open jeeps that they've created, was attacked by an angry mob of crowd who surged forward throwing eggs. He was pelted in the head with eggs. Actually, we have the video on the Latin American Herald Tribune today under Venezuela's stories today. From several different places. But the state television actually had to cut away and cut the shot when they saw that he was under siege, because that would be embarrassing. And then in some of the Periscope videos or the you know, everyone's a reporter these days with the cell phones. It's a fantastic opportunity, even though, you know, countries like Venezuela try and black out the news that they don't like. But everyone has become a truth teller with a phone. And you can hear the crowd yelling Maldito and all kinds of things and pelting him with eggs. So you can actually see what happened after.
Russ Dallin, let me just ask you quickly in closing a question about the play that apparently some American firms are now making on Wall Street to purchase PDVSA bonds. What's going on with that? Does it help the Venezuelan regime, or is it actually a further strain on them?
It is a mild help, but it's a greater strain on them, actually, because the market already thinks that they're going to default. So with that onus on them, they've gone above and beyond in paying Wall Street and their creditors. Imagine this. They'll starve their population. There's no medicine for illness, for old people, for young people. 95% of medicines are not on the shelves. There's just no drugs available. This month and next month, the country owes $3.7 billion. Today alone, they have a coupon payment and of three bonds and a maturity that they have to pay $2.34 billion today.
We'll be looking for your reporting on it, needless to say, at the Latin America Herald Tribune. Russ Dahlin, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.